I'm Lillian Vasquez with Lifestyles on KVCR. Thanks for listening. On today's show, I'll speak with the former Press Enterprise columnist, Dan Bernstein. He's written a new book, Justice in Plain Sight. It's the story about our local newspaper, the Press Enterprise, and how it fought in the early 80s to inform readers about shocking crimes in the city. Some judges were not allowing the press in the courtrooms. Jim Ward, a business lawyer with the PE, was an unlikely lawyer to face the challenges to change the rules and open America's courtrooms. We'll talk about the local cases making it to the U.S. Supreme Court and the issues of First Amendment rights, including the rights for the public to witness jury selection. My conversation with Dan Bernstein is coming up next, right after the NPR newscast. This is Lifestyles. I'm Lillian Vasquez. Dan Bernstein was a longtime columnist for one of our local newspapers, the Press Enterprise. He is the author of two children's books. I'm told he plays the trombone and at one time was a contributor to KVCR back in the day as Bernstein with a Twist. But today we're talking about his newest book, Justice in Plain Sight. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you, Lillian. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so will you share a little bit of your story and how you ended up being a columnist at the Press Enterprise?
Yeah, it was certainly not well thought out on my part. I came to the paper as a reporter in 1976, and that's what I did for a good number of years. I covered politics, county government, redevelopment, business and labor. And in 1980, I moved to the editorial page, and it was a great sort of experience writing editorials for the paper. But we had a local columnist named Tom Green who loved show business, and he got a call from this startup newspaper asking if he'd like to be the Westwood correspondent, and that was that startup was USA Today. And that was 1982, and that created a vacancy. And I was happy writing editorials, but I was encouraged to at least apply to be a columnist. And I wrote a couple of samples. And Norman Chernus, who's the executive editor, said in a not terribly encouraging way, well, we'll give this a try.
And how long did you go on to do that after that?
32 years. I retired in 2014. So it was quite a long run, actually.
And how was it writing a weekly column? Were you ever short of ideas?
Actually, I wrote four a week, but I think
it was
easier to write four a week rather than one, because I'm told by people who write just one column a week that they get it done, and then there's not a lot of pressure to think about what you're going to write next until six or seven more days out. And with me, I always had to be on my toes, what's next. And there were times when I figured I would have to tell the editors I was sick or have them put something in the paper. But I really got a lot of help from my colleagues and from readers. They kind of developed a sense of what I was interested in. And also from my wife, who is a very bright idea person. So fortunately, I wrote some bad columns, no doubt about it. I had some I'm not proud of. But all in all, I was able to kind of maintain this what I thought was a good rhythm, so that if people didn't like what I was writing about one day, they would tune in the next time, because I try to make it a variety, kind of write about a variety of things.
Kind of like Lifestyles. I try to make it a variety of topics so that hopefully I can attract everybody at one point, because you certainly can't please everybody every time, that's for sure.
Right, yeah. And they're just, and I think that the question that they would have for you and for me was, well, I wonder what's going to be next, rather than, oh, I bet it's going to be the same old thing.
I'll have to put that in my office and say, I wonder what's going to be next. I hope it's not the same old thing.
Yeah, that's true. Always at risk, I guess.
All right, well, let's talk about the book, How a Small Town Newspaper and Its Unlikely Lawyer Opened America's Courtrooms. What were you trying to accomplish by writing this book?
Well, I was trying to do a couple of things, really. That's a good question. I was trying to do a couple of things. I was trying to tell the story of the Press Enterprise, which was a really comparatively small newspaper. It wasn't in the top 100 in the United States, and it wasn't even the top 10 in California at the time. But it was a paper that had some very passionate leaders, journalistic leaders. Tim Hayes, who's the owner of the paper, and Norman Chernus, the executive editor of the paper, and also Mel Apatowski, who's the managing editor of the paper. And what they wanted to do, in a nutshell, was serve the community. They thought that whatever happened in our circulation area that was worth writing about, we would write about it and tell the whole story. So that's when I wanted to kind of discuss the newspaper's tenacity when judges in many high-profile cases, murder cases, were basically kicking the public out of the courtroom and doing so without any explanation whatsoever. So that's one story I wanted to tell the paper, tell about the crimes, tell about the reasons why the press and public were being kicked out of the courtrooms, and tell about what the Press Enterprise decided to do about it. But I also wanted to give readers an idea of how the Supreme Court works. The interesting thing was that at the time this was happening in Riverside and all other up and down the state of California and other places, and when I say this is happening, I mean courtrooms being closed to the public.
Right.
The Supreme Court was grappling with this very issue, and so the Press Enterprise cases were in a context of an evolution on the Supreme Court's part. That in itself was really interesting, the cases were, but also the Supreme Court is kind of a mysterious institution, and I thought would be a good thing for me to learn and hopefully for the readers to understand how it works, how a case gets to the Supreme Court, what has to happen before they even decide to hear it, what role do the clerks play, what do they do during oral arguments, how do they decide after these arguments are over, and then who writes the opinion, and how do those opinions get edited, not only by them, but by their young law clerks who have quite a bit of power.
My guest is Dan Bernstein. He's the author of Justice in Plain Sight. Dan, who are the players in your book that play an important role, and you're really kind of telling their story within the Press Enterprise?
That's right. I would say first, Tim Hayes, at the time the co-publisher and editor and co-owner of the Press Enterprise. It was owned by two families at one point. Norman Chernus, who was the executive editor at the time, he came to the Press Enterprise, I believe, in the 50s as an editorial writer. Tim Hayes owned the paper. He took over in 1949 from his dad, and he didn't really think that, and he was right, that editorials were his long suit. So he hired an editorial page editor and writer, and that was Norman. By the time these stories unfolded, Tim was the owner and Norman was the executive editor. There was Jim Ward, who was a business lawyer for the paper, not just a business lawyer, but certainly not a constitutional lawyer. Uh-huh. He handled business matters for the paper. As reporters kept getting kicked out of Riverside County Superior Courtrooms, Norman Chernus would send Jim Ward down to the courts and say, you've got to open these doors, you've got to reconsider. And the judges would keep saying no, and Jim, it was his task to then appeal to up the ladder to the State Court of Appeal, the California Supreme Court, and then ultimately, because of the trust that he had earned from Tim and Norman, he was tasked to argue these cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, even though there was a lot of interest in among East Coast First Amendment lawyers to swoop in and take this case over, because they were worried that this rookie would bungle it, and not only would the Press Enterprise lose a case, but the cause of a First Amendment and openness and access would be lost as well.
So First Amendment was an important thought process going on. But I want to ask, what were the cases involved here in Riverside, or here locally in the Inland Empire?
Yes, this book concerns three cases that were founded on crimes that took place within a year of each other. There was the 1980 Norco bank robbery,
right,
which resulted in a lot of mayhem and, tragically, in the death of a Riverside County Sheriff's Deputy, James B. Evans. That was in May of 1980. In October of 1980, there was a brutal rape and murder of an Arlington High School sophomore, Susan Louise Jordan, who was on her way to school in Riverside, walking along Victoria Avenue, and she was snatched off the avenue and dragged into the orange groves, where she was raped and murdered. And then a few months later, I think March of 1981, there was a a couple of weeks span where a nurse named Robert Diaz injected at least 12 patients in a Paris hospital with lethal overdoses of a drug called lidocaine, and that killed them. And he was the serial killer that was charged with those murders and later on convicted.
So those were the three crimes. Right, and all of these were, they were all seeking death penalty? Is that why they were so, because they were death penalty cases?
Yes, and that's a very good question. These were all death penalty cases, and in fact, this, we're talking here about the early 1980s.
Right.
And in the late 1970s, 1977, 78, California legislature and voters reinstated the death penalty.
Mm.
So this was a time when death penalty cases were really stacking up. And the closures of these courtrooms were aided by a California Supreme Court ruling in 1980 that said that prospective jurors in death penalty cases would be questioned individually and in sequestration when it got to the point of jury selection called death qualifying, which meant that this is when jurors would be asked their views about the death penalty, if there had been similar crimes committed, or if there's similar crimes in their families where family members had been victims, very personal questions, and the prosecution and defense and judge worried that if the public were in the courtroom, then prospective jurors might not be totally candid,
right,
because they didn't want all their personal problems and tragedies coming out and getting widespread circulation in the newspaper.
And then is it a spoiler alert to talk about how it ended up and how it ended up at the Supreme Court and what were the results?
No, not at all. Here's a little bit of perspective how to look at this. Defendants in criminal trials had the right to a speedy and public trial. They had that right since 1791 when the Bill of Rights were adopted to the Constitution, Bill of Rights amendments to the Constitution. This is the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution. The public and the press, however, did not have the right to watch these trials, to be in the courtroom, did not have a First Amendment constitutional right until 1980.
Mm.
And the press enterprise cases were the two that came shortly after that landmark decision in 1980. It was called Richmond Newspapers versus Virginia, which declared that the public and the press had a First Amendment right to access to criminal trials. But that ruling did not address what the press enterprise was after, and that was a First Amendment right of access to jury selection and later to preliminary hearings. And those are important because jury selection, think about it, if you're in a death penalty case and jury selection is conducted in secret, the public has no idea whether the system works, who is called to serve on the jury, who was selected, who was not, what kind of questions were they asked. It was all done in secret, yet these 12 people would have the power to find someone guilty and sentence him or her to death. But we had no idea who these people were. And similarly, in preliminary hearings are the last step before trial. Prosecution tries to lay out its case and convince a judge that, yes, this person ought to be held over for trial. The thing is that only 10% of cases actually go to trial, so that 90% of criminal cases, including death penalty cases, are resolved at the preliminary hearing level. But those were, again, being conducted in secret. So the public had no real chance to sit in the courtroom and decide for themselves whether the justice system was working properly. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't say they had no chance, but they had very little chance, considering that all those preliminary hearings were, and that's where a lot of the action was.
So it was about holding things accountable.
Exactly. And holding the courtrooms accountable so that the public would have confidence in the judicial system is really as simple as that. That's what Tim and Norma believe. And they're known as Press Enterprise 1 and Press Enterprise 2. Press Enterprise 1 was a jury selection case. That received a 9-0 ruling in favor of the Press Enterprise.
Mm.
2 years later, the preliminary hearing case, Press Enterprise 2, the Press Enterprise won that with a 7-2 vote. The two dissenting justices, Rehnquist and John Paul Stevens, worried that first would be preliminary hearing access, but then the press would be back to argue for grand jury access.
Mm.
And they voted that they didn't want to see that happen, so they voted against Press Enterprise and Press Enterprise 2.
After a quick break, I'll continue my interview with retired columnist and author Dan Bernstein. You're listening to Lifestyles. I'm Lillian Vasquez. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with author Dan Bernstein, who has written a book about our local newspaper, the Press Enterprise, and the role it played in the U.S. Supreme Court. Do you feel you accomplished what you set out to do?
I think, yes, I do. I really do. And here's why. It's not just that they won these cases, that's kind of when I started out doing this. I knew that this was a good local story because the Press Enterprise had won these cases, and not very many newspapers go to the Supreme Court once, let alone twice. So that was good, and that showed the commitment that Tim and Norman had to the paper. But these cases, Press Enterprise 1 and 2, since they were the last of four in which the Supreme Court was evolving to open up the courtrooms, have been cited thousands of times since, and in some big cases. And let me just give you one example.
Sure.
In 2014, which is not that long ago, there was a judge in Arapahoe County, Colorado, and he was asked to make a ruling. And the ruling was the prosecution and the defense were arguing, not against each other, they were arguing to him that jury selection should be closed in this case. It's a capital case, the Aurora Theater shooting, if you remember.
Yes.
That one. That
yes.
Was the mass murder of people who were in the audience in the showing of The Dark Knight Rises.
Right.
So the prosecution and defense thought that this was a high-profile case. We don't want to taint the jury pool. We want to keep this jury selection closed so that the defendant can get a fair trial. And what the judge said is, no, you haven't convinced me. You haven't outlined specific reasons why there are no other alternatives besides closure to accomplish your goal. So I'm paraphrasing what the judge said, but what
yes.
the judge actually did was cite word for word these U.S. Supreme Court rulings in Press Enterprise 1 and Press Enterprise 2.
Hmm.
And those rulings, what they did was they totally shifted the burden from the public clamoring to get in to see their justice system at work to the judge having to explain on the record and very specifically why he or she was closing the courtroom. That was a tremendous shift in burden. So that First Amendment right that the press and public earned with Press Enterprise 1 and 2 is not absolute. It's qualified. But if the judges are going to close their courtrooms, they have to be very careful to explain why so that that reasoning can be appealed to a higher court, which can say, yes, you did the right thing, or no, you've got to do this again. But no longer do judges just have this arbitrary right to close their courtroom. That's the real contribution of Press Enterprise 1 and Press Enterprise 2 in the preliminary hearing and jury selection arenas.
Did you have this story kicking in your head for a long time and you thought you'd write it when you retired from the PE, or what provoked you to write it at this time?
Actually, Elaine, it was a fluke.
Oh.
A little fluke. I was wrapping up my career at the Press Enterprise, and a lawyer in town, Virginia Blumenthal, a criminal defense lawyer,
yes.
called me up and asked me if I'd like to write a positive column for a change. And I initially balked, of course, but I figured, well, why not? What's the story? And she said that she and a former mock trial student of hers, Virginia was a coach of mock trial at Pauley,
right.
and this former student had gone to law school and become a deputy DA. They were going to go up against each other in the California Supreme Court, and I should write a column about that and take some pictures because, you know, now newspaper reporters took pictures.
Right.
So I went down to the historic courthouse in Riverside, and I took a few pictures, and Virginia said, no, now we're going to go inside. And we went into the beautiful, restored courtroom number 1 in the county courthouse. And the judge there let us have the run of the place. And then at one point she came out and said, now, so what's this all about? And Virginia told her, and the judge named Sharon Waters said, well, you ought to do what we did in the Press Enterprise cases and have a moot court, kind of a rehearsal before you go up to San Francisco and argue your case. Well, it turned out that didn't register with me at first. It did maybe a few hours later, but Sharon Waters, before she became a judge, worked at Thompson and Colgate, which that was Jim Ward's firm, and she worked for Jim Ward as a young associate attorney. She was very instrumental in writing briefs to the Supreme Court for those cases.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of hours after she said that, the light bulb went on. I said, hey, you know, I know those cases. I don't know much about them. I just know that we won them. This might be something I could do after I leave the paper. That's kind of how it happened. It was an accident.
Hmm. My guest is Dan Bernstein. He's the author of Justice in Plain Sight. You recently had a public conversation with Jim Ward and Mal here in the Inland Empire. How did that go?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, Jim, he argued the cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. And then Mal Apatowski, who was the managing editor of the Press Enterprise, actually was the paper's point man in Press Enterprise too, which meant that he helped supervise the writing of the brief, that very important step, because the justices have to read these briefs before the oral arguments, and those briefs are critical to their decisions. Mel and Jim and I, we kind of build ourselves as the antique roadshow. Because we're getting up there. We've gone to several presentations, and they've gone quite well. So he's able to recount firsthand what he did there.
Oh, nice.
And Mel is a co-founder of California First Amendment Coalition.
Mm-hmm.
So he was able to put Press Enterprise campaigns for transparency and for access into perspective, because there were a lot of closures going on up and down the state, and he knew about them.
So the three of you in your room probably make for some good conversation.
Yeah, it really was. And Mel and Jim are very comical, because they kind of have this sort of, they spar with each other. They make me sit in between them because they don't get along. Well, actually, they're very good friends, but they kind of snipe at each other from time to time. So it was very entertaining.
Good dialogue, I'm sure.
Yeah.
What's next on your bucket list?
Well,
your to-do list. Maybe your to-do list.
I don't know. I'm doing some volunteer work around town, which I really enjoy. One's a reading program for juvenile offenders, and one, I'm doing some music therapy at Kaiser. You mentioned I play trombone at Kaiser Hospital once a week, and I'm getting a lot of joy out of that. I've been doing that actually since before I retired. But I think probably some kind of writing is on the horizon. I did promise my wife I would never do this again, because it took a good long time. It took about 4 years. We'll see. I might start lobbying sometime soon.
Is there another book in you?
There could be. You know, now that I've done one, I'm not as intimidated as I used to be. That was I called this my daunting project. It was really, it was tough for me to commit actually doing it. In the early stages, I kept telling people I would interview that I'm thinking of doing a book about these Press Enterprise cases, and it took me a while to actually take the plunge. But I do enjoy writing, and I enjoy learning about something, you know, learning about something new and then communicating it so that a general audience can learn something along with me. So I can't say, yes, I'm definitely going to write another book, but it's an intriguing thought, actually.
A little harder than a children's book, I'm guessing.
Yeah, although, you know, children's books aren't easy. Children's books are, the markets are ever-changing in children's books.
Sure.
I remember when I first wrote one in the mid-90s, there was a lot of text in that book. And now a children's picture book is maybe 500 words tops. So things have really tailed back. So it's a different challenge, much different, but it's there.
Dan, thanks so much for talking about your new book and about our city that you know very well right here in our Inland Empire region. Thanks so much.
Lillian, thank you very much for asking me these great questions, and I really appreciate you having me on.
That's our show. To hear any past interviews, visit our website at kvcrnews.org/lifestyles. While you're on our webpage, leave me a message or a suggestion for a topic that interests you. Thanks to all who helped to make the show possible, including David Fleming, Sharina Wadd, Sean Houlihan, and executive producer Rick Dulock. Ethan Bortnick provides our theme music. Join me next week at the same time for Lifestyles with me, Lillian Vasquez. Bye for now.